at the University of Georgia Griffin with Dr. Lou Honeycutt and his guests. The program is made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farms and Murray & Company Realtors. And now today's program with Dr. Lou Honeycutt.
Well, good morning, Griffin, Spalding, and the surrounding area. We are proud to be back with you all this week for another edition of the Griffin Campus News. I say this every week, but we have a great show today. So we have, an even greater show today. We have got one of our partner agencies that is on campus with us today and been there for quite a long period of time. We are going to talk today with the National Plant, and I'm going to say this really long deal, and then we'll talk about really what we call it. But the National Plant Germplasm Collection at the Plant Genetics Resource Conservation Center, USDA, ARS, UGA Griffin Campus. Whew, that's a long one. But today with me, I've got Dr. Melanie Harrison, who's the research leader for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Dr. Sean Tallery, the peanut curator, which I think you have one of the coolest names ever, the peanut curator. That's cool. U.S. Department of Ag. And then Miley Mobley, who's a relatively newcomer and has a connection to Griffin that I think most people in here probably know, but she'll talk about that in a minute, but a biological science technician at the University of Georgia Griffin. So what we do at the start of the show every time, and Melanie, I'm going to start with you, is you got to tell your life story, sing and dance, whatever you want to do, but just how did you get to this seat today? So let's talk about, you know, where you went to high school, where you grew up, just all the way up to now.
All right. Hope it's interesting.
It will be.
I actually grew up in Warner Robins, Georgia. I went to Northside High School. And then I went to undergrad in Carrollton at the University of Georgia, where I got my degree in biology. I spent some time up in Atlanta and went to Emory University studying nutrition and health sciences.
Okay.
Then I ended up taking a position with the germplasm system on the UGA Griffin campus in 1997. I actually worked for the University of Georgia then. I was a technician. I was married and had two children and just a working mom, and then decided to go back to school and get my doctorate in horticulture at the University of Georgia. And I was able to do so, and a position opened up with the USDA side of the plant germplasm system. So I took that position. I was a curator of the warm season grass collection for about 15 years. And a year and a half ago, I was promoted to the research leader for the unit. So I've been in Griffin since 1997 and working with the germplasm system.
And that's a great story. And when I met you, one of the first things someone told me about you was that you were the warm seasons curator. And I love grasses. I'm a range grass guy, but I knew we'd get along because we had the same interests. But and then also, who did you work under for your PhD?
Carol Robacker.
That's what I thought.
Dr. Robacker is a professor in horticulture, and she works with native azaleas, abelias, and some other horticultural crops. So I did a project on azaleas and also worked with them on peanuts, actually, for my project.
And it had to be a great experience. We'll give a shout-out to Carol because what she has done in her program over the time she's been at UGA is incredible. And, you know, a whole lot of people around the world and certainly around the nation can appreciate when they plant things they have no idea where they came from, but they probably came from right here, a lot of them.
Yeah, she is. She's an excellent mentor, so I really appreciate her taking me in her wing and letting me be her graduate student while I was here. And what's really neat about it is that now that I'm still on the Griffin campus, Dr. Redbacker and I have had joint collaborations developing ornamental little blue stems,
exactly,
and other native grasses. So we've continuing that relationship over the past
few days. Say some of the names, because I love the names y'all name your little blue stems.
It's Cinnamon Girl, Seasons in the Sun, and Good Vibrations.
And those happen to be rock and roll songs from a while back.
Yes.
Which I think is pretty cool. But, well, that's great. Okay, well, we're going to move down the road to Miley. Miley, tell us your life story. And you're so young, there can't be a whole lot in it, but but tell us your life story and tell us that connection I mentioned in that you might have someone in Griffin.
Well, I was born and raised in Griffin. I went to Spalding High School, and then after I graduated high school, I went to the University of West Georgia as well, and I got my bachelor's in biology, and I graduated in the summer of 2017, and I started at the UGA Griffin campus in the turfgrass building with Dr. Raymer. He gave me a part-time position, and that's how I figured out I was interested in agriculture. So after my part-time position, I reached out and applied for the position as Shams' research technician, and I was so lucky enough to get it. I must have made a good impression. So And now I've been there about a year now.
Very cool. And who's the connection I keep mentioning that you may have? You have a grandfather. Right? Oh. Everyone listening knows.
Yes, Dick Morrow is my grandfather.
Who happens to be the man of the year for Griffin. And that's pretty incredible. I think that's awesome. So
it was the Exchange Club, and I want to know what we got for him.
That's pretty good. Well, awesome. We're glad you're there, too. I remember the day that he brought you to my office, and we just sat and talked, and he said, if there's ever anything open, and then you all did it on your own. He took you around and visited, and the rest is history. It's all about doors opening and who you meet and who you talk to. And you're in a great place. I know you know that, but I certainly know that, too. And who knows what's going to happen in the future. We were talking out in the lobby about PhD and all kinds of stuff maybe in the future.
Yes, I'm super excited. So we'll see what will happen in the future.
Awesome. Okay, well, now we're down to Sham. You have an incredible story because you don't have a Georgia accent. So let's talk about that, but tell us your life story.
Well, thanks, Lou. I'm originally from India. I grew up in southern part of India, so I claim myself as a southerner, actually.
Gotcha.
And my dad was a school teacher, so we all went to the same school where he was working.
Ooh, that's never good.
And then after graduating from high school, I went into ag school for my undergrad in India, actually. I was interested, as Miley said, excited about agriculture and plants. So did my bachelor's in India, and then also my master's later in the northwestern part of India, actually, a state called Punjab. It's Punjab Agricultural University, and they have an excellent program for plant breeding. So my training is in plant breeding. So I went to do my master's there. I did in wheat research, actually, okay. Wheat breeding. And after that, I moved back to my hometown in the south central India. It's called Hyderabad, where there's an international ag research institute there, actually. It's called ICRISAT, International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics.
Okay.
So a peanut was one of their mandate crops there. So I started working in peanut many, many years ago. And while I was working there, we had a collaborative project with North Carolina State University in Raleigh. So I was working on that collaborative project. So faculty from NC State would visit us once a year for evaluations and progress reports. And that's how I got connected to faculty at NC State,
okay.
The peanut breeding group. So I came to NC State for my graduate school, where I did my PhD in peanut breeding, and worked there later as a postdoc in peanut breeding, and then a position became open to run the peanut breeding program using the wild species of peanuts.
Right, okay.
So I took over that program, and then I stayed in Raleigh for 25 years, actually. And then an opportunity came up with Clemson University back in 2013. And so I left NC State to move to Clemson University as a peanut breeder.
Okay.
And it's a whole new program they started. So to set up a program was so exciting. So I moved to Clemson. And I was at the PD Research and Education Center in Florence, South Carolina,
where
the peanut breeding program was located. And I was there for a couple of years, and then in 2015, the peanut curator position became open on Griffin campus
sure.
at the USDA. And my passion has always been in germplasm and genetic diversity, so I was fortunate to get the job here, and I've been in Griffin since November of 2015.
You came when I did, just about the same time I did, which
yeah,
is kind of awesome.
I remember.
So they got the best they ever had in two, one.
Yeah,
two,
I think we joined on the same day. I started November 2nd, 2015.
Yes, that's me too, so that's awesome. Well, great. That's an incredible story, and I love to talk about everyone on the show or have them talk about themselves to get the local flavor, but also get the international flavor. We actually have we have 30-plus countries represented on campus between students and faculty and researchers, and to me that's incredible to be able to talk about the international flavor. flair that we have.
Wonderful.
So,
yes.
And this week we've got a group on campus. It's called DSAT. Don't get me to tell you what that means. But there's over 30 countries. There's 80 people in over 30 countries. Literally spread across the world on campus this week. It's awesome to have that exposure of all of us to the international flair. So, okay, Melanie, let's talk. I said the long thing at the start. Let's talk, because most people probably don't know what germplasm is. Most people probably don't know what anything I read was at the start of the show. I say the seed bank all the time, and I know that's not truly what it is, but let's talk about what it is that you do and what it is that you run.
Well, it's easy to think of us as a seed bank. Because people can relate to that.
Sure.
Because we do store a lot of seeds. We have over 100,000 samples of seeds that represent plants that have been collected from all over the world, from 188 different countries.
Wow.
So germplasm is living plant germplasm is living plant tissue.
Okay.
And so normally seeds are living plant tissue. So we store germplasm here, mainly as seeds, but we also have a in vitro collection. So we have little tissue culture test tubes full of sweet potatoes. And we also have clonal species of grasses that we maintain in the greenhouse and clonal peanuts, and we have a bamboo collection. So not everything we have is maintained as seed. But this whole collection of over 100,000 samples is very important. It represents a lot of genetic diversity in our crops. The crops we have here are the ones that will do well in the southeast.
Okay.
We have peanuts, warm season grasses. We have sorghum, a lot of different vegetable crops, including okra, eggplant, pepper. We have watermelon, different legumes such as vigna. A lot of people think of it as black-eyed peas. and so we have a lot of diversity in the collection, and we store it in these cold rooms and freezers. And it doesn't just sit there. We distribute it to researchers, scientists, and plant breeders who request our material. We do this for free of charge. send small samples for research purposes. And they range from looking at trying to look at the oleic acid and peanut, different peanut samples to see, identify ones that have high oleic acid so they can breed a peanut that has healthier oils. They're looking at disease resistance for different things, and just a lot of different uses our germplasm has. So.
And I think that's what several things are so cool about that is that your predecessor, I know you probably say it too, but used to say when you'd walk in, the cure for cancer is somewhere in these stacks. I mean, because plants are typically where we find those. But also the cure for a lot of other diseases are found that may be a cure for a disease in some other plant could be stored in a seed that you have in the seed bank.
Yes.
I think that's incredible. So there are how many across the nation? Are there 12? Is that what you're talking about?
So we're actually part of a national system that's managed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
We're the agency we're in within the USDA is the Agricultural Research Service, which
okay.
is the premier agricultural research agency. They do a lot of very cutting-edge research and try to so that farmers can grow better crops, so that consumers can have more nutritious and safe, healthy food supply. But the system, the National Plant Germplasm System, is made up of sites across the United States, very much like the one in Griffin. Actually, I think there's 21 sites now.
Oh, okay.
And so
awesome.
Each site has a different set of crops they maintain. So the ones here we maintain are, you know, like I said, those ones that are important in the southeast. But in all of the collections in the U.S. are actually backed up at Fort Collins, Colorado. So in case there was some type of natural disaster,
sure.
a tornado comes through Griffin and, you know, blows our seed storage away, which we hope never happens, then those materials are backed up at Fort Collins. But in the entire National Plant Germplasm System, there's roughly 600,000 samples.
Wow.
There's,
okay.
Right now, there's 15,970 different species that are represented.
Good.
In the whole,
that's incredible.
In the whole collection. And just in the Griffin, we have 1,600 different species just in Griffin alone. So very diverse.
Oh, that's awesome.
And speaking about, you know, the cure for cancer and in one of our accessions, Sean has a great story about probably $1 million bag of peanuts we have in the collection.
Oh, cool. Let's talk about that. That's great. That's how we can introduce the peanut collection, because, again, I think that is so awesome.
Yeah. Thank you, Melanie, for bringing that
That's a good
out.
Segue. That's great.
Yeah. And yeah, we pride ourselves, actually. We have that the peanut PI. It's a plant introduction 203396 in our collection, which was the main source for resistance to the tomato spotted wilt virus. Actually.
Fantastic.
And this plant introduction was collected way back in 1952 in Brazil.
Wow.
And it's been sitting in our gene bank until 1972, actually. So for 20 years, it was just like any other seed of bat,
sure,
actually, sitting in the cold storage. And the peanut breeder from University of Florida, Dr. Dan Gorbett, was looking for some leaf spot resistance for peanut. So he had requested several PIs from the collection in 1972, and this was one of them, the PI 203396. And he made cross-hybridization of different types, and then he was trying to find a line that's resistant to leaf spot, actually. So he found one with this PI in its pedigree as resistant. So he released that line as a variety, actually.
Okay.
Southern Runner Peanut in the late 70s. And when tomato-spotted wilt virus started showing up in Southeast, particularly in Georgia, in the early 90s, and by 1992, 93, 94, around that time, it was almost to the extreme levels, actually,
okay,
causing epidemic levels of disease. And then the industry was very worried that it might destroy the whole peanut crop.
Okay.
But Dr. Bill Branch in Tifton, UGA peanut breeder, was using Southern Runner in his program for hybridization work, actually, to improve leaf spot resistance. And then he found a line out of his program was highly resistant to tomato spotted wilt virus, actually. So he released that in 1996 as a Georgia Green peanut variety,
okay,
with extreme field tolerance to tomato spotted wilt, which practically saved the entire peanut industry.
Wow. That's incredible.
So there are a lot of derived lines from Georgia Green and PI 203396 in almost in all the peanuts that are grown in the Southeast, actually.
Good night. And peanuts are kind of important in Georgia. I mean, just a little bit. So that's awesome.
Yeah, that's true. We grow in any year, actually, almost 50% of the country's production,
exactly,
in Georgia.
And that could have been wiped out,
yeah,
except for a bag of seed. That to me is what that there's, and there's probably 100 other stories y'all could tell like that, but that is one example of how critically important what y'all do is. And it, I have to tell you, when I applied, one of the key factors in me looking closely at this campus is it said there was a seed bank on campus. But I tell this story a lot, but I was under the impression that it'd be like Svalbard, Norway, where we would walk into an ice cave or something. So I was a little discouraged when they took me in and opened a freezer. But I loved it after that. But I thought it was going to be a little bit different. But what y'all do is incredible. And I think, Melanie, just with that story, the sharing of the – y'all don't hide the seeds and y'all don't keep them under wraps and not share them. And the point of the whole system is to disperse and regrow and look at hybrid – all kind, everything that has – and a lot of countries don't do that, do they?
Well, a lot of countries have their own germplasm collection. Some are not as accessible as ours. That's one thing we pride ourselves on is the diversity in the collection and also the accessibility. So we have a website. It's the GRIN Global website, and GRIN stands for Germplasm Resources Information,
okay,
Network. And so plant breeders, researchers, educators can go on that website, and they can see everything that we have in the collection, all those 600-plus accessions. When I say accessions, I mean samples.
Sure.
Or unique plant populations. So they can see what the material we have there, the different species, where a particular sample came from, who collected it, what year. Sometimes there's, depending on the crop, there might be a lot of data associated
okay
with the germplasm, such as basic data like plant height and width and things like that, but also more specific data to the crop, such as in peanuts, they have oleic acid content that we have.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
So a breeder can go through there and choose materials that's best
sure
for their program.
And before you get bombarded with emails or on that website, it has to be research oriented. Like if I'm on garden in my yard, I can't order tomatoes from you, can I?
No, it probably wouldn't be the best idea either. So it's for research purposes only,
okay,
and we don't want to compete with seed companies. You know, so it's best to
sure
to buy your seeds commercially if you're planning a home garden. And also Seed Savers Exchange is an organization we refer people to a lot of times.
Very
they
cool
do a lot of heirloom varieties that they they collect, and you can order through them too. So a lot of the home gardeners will refer to them. And a lot of our plant materials aren't necessarily suitable for home gardening. Like I said, there's a lot of diversity in our collection, so that peanut that was had provided that resistance to that virus, it might not have been the best peanut straight out
without
development, and you know, since we would grow and get a lot of yield or a very tasty peanut, you know, so it's not a lot of our materials are wild species and things like that, so they're very important to provide genetic diversity for plant breeders, but there's not something that necessarily might just be right straight ready for your home garden.
No, that makes sense. And I know that, and Shalma, I want to come back to you in just a second and talk about, you've shown me like a lot of the native peanuts, they don't look like regular peanuts to the rest of us. So I want to talk about that. I want to get to Molly. I want to get Molly engaged in the conversation. You are relatively new to the seed bank or to the PGRCU. Tell me what are you doing? I mean, tell me what you don't like, because Sean's sitting here. But tell me what you like. I mean, what's a typical day? I know there are no typical days, but what's some of the things you're doing right now?
Well, during the summer, because this is our busiest time of the year planting. So mainly I maintain the plants in the greenhouses and the field, just, you know, doing whatever needs to be done. When it gets to a certain time in the year, I will take plant data, and which will turn into the Green Global system, so people can look at it.
That's great. And you don't just work in Griffin, do you?
Oh, no. That's where the peanuts are grown, actually, in Byron, Georgia, which is an hour away.
Sure. So, I mean, you're not just stuck in a greenhouse in Griffin. You get to travel a little bit and do some things.
Yeah, and I get to travel down the road past the UGA Griffin Gardens to Westbrook. That's where we have a couple of fields.
Sure. So that's great. I mean, have you – and how – so when did you start? When did you move over to this position?
Last April.
Okay, so over a year. So are you going to stick around?
I mean, yes, I have to say that now. For a little bit.
Cool.
We hope so.
No, exactly. It is so hard to find really good people. I know Molly's been great for the campus and for y'all, so I think that's great. Okay, Sean, let's talk a little bit about the peanut. Well, let me ask Melanie another question, then we'll come back to you. When you start, when an accession bag or when a bag of seeds starts running low, do you just let it go away forever? What do you do?
No, so we monitor. Everything is in a database, so we know how many seeds are in each packet. And so when it starts to get low, or if the viability or the germination starts to drop, we'll do a seed increase. And the way we know our germination is that we have a germination technician. Her name is Fifi Vankus, and she tests our germplasm. We have new material coming in the collection, and she periodically checks material that's already in the collection to see how the germination rate is. It starts to get low, she lets the curator know, or the scientist, you know, who takes care of a particular crop, and then we'll flag it for seed increase. We'll grow it out in the field, and we'll harvest new seeds, and then and put it back into the cold room.
So it's a true living dynamic system, which I think is so great, because a lot of people think cold storage, you put them in the freezer and you forget about them, but that doesn't last forever.
No, they don't last forever. They'll last a long time if you grow the plants properly and harvest the seed and handle them correctly. But it's not an infinite number of years they can make our job a lot easier if it would do that.
Exactly. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, what's some of the oldest seed in the collection right now, year-wise? I mean, when would it have been collected?
Well, we start the station. We started on the station in 1949.
Right.
And I think we had about 800 accessions at that time.
Wow,
so that's probably some of our officially...
And are some of those seeds still in the collection?
We maintain the original seeds. We usually keep those, but that's not usually what we distribute from. We usually distribute from the newer seed increases. So,
but that's awesome. I mean, that's history and everything else along with that.
Yes, and I went to Fort Collins a year or two ago to look at their facilities, and I believe, and don't quote me on this, but I think there was a tomato they tried to germinate, and I want to say it was from the 50s.
Wow.
They got it to germinate. So it's amazing what they can do. So
that's incredible. Well, you know, Mother Nature is pretty powerful, and we've seen, for me being a native pasture grass person, we've seen grass seed lay dormant out in the environment forever, and gets the right conditions, and poof, you have grass you haven't seen in 20 years. So, I mean, it's Mother Nature's pretty critically important. I tell you what, Tony, can we take our bottom of the hour break, and then we'll come back, talk more about, I want to talk about peanuts and all things to do with peanuts when we come back.
You're listening to the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News on AM 1450 WKEU in Griffin, Georgia. Also heard on 102.3 FM and 88.9 FM, The Rock, Georgia Public Radio in its finest. We're streaming worldwide on the web at WKEUradio.com, and you can take us with you wherever you go, courtesy of the free WKEU app, available for all smartphone and tablet devices. Our morning program continues after this.
Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray and Company Realty. Proud supporters of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus and proud to bring you this week's edition of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. As the UGA Griffin Campus grows with the great educational opportunities for our children, Round Oak Resources Tree Farm is growing our future with trees to support and assist our environment. Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors are proud supporters of the UGA Griffin Campus and area youth activities in Griffin and Spalding County.
Time now to resume this morning's University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. For that, let us turn the proceedings over to the Campus Director and Assistant Provost, Dr. Lou Honeycutt.
Thank you, Tony. Welcome back, everybody. We are having a great show today talking with the National Plant Germplasm Collection people from the University of Georgia. We've got lots of acronyms that and they're all good, that we refer to them as. But it's Dr. Melanie Harrison, who's the research leader, the boss, if you will, for the U.S. Department of Ag on campus. Dr. Sean Tallery, peanut curator, and Ms. Miley Mobley, who is a biological science technician and has been with the group for about a year. And Sean, you and I were talking during the break. There's lots of collaboration amongst the people that work for USDA. So, like, how many scientists are there? And then let's just kind of talk about the collaboration that goes on. No one's an island to themselves, right?
Melanie and Miley both mentioned about what we do on a daily basis, and Melanie also mentioned that we have about close to 100,000 entities in our gene bank. So when you have that many entities, it's a large collection of germplasm. So we got five scientists in our unit.
Okay.
And then we got each program has at least one technician to assist the scientists. So we can do our jobs without the assistance we get from the technicians and other scientists, actually. And for example, when we're planting peanuts or harvesting peanuts, those are the main operations, take a lot of labor time. So particularly when we're digging peanuts and then harvesting peanuts, we get help from all other technicians in the program, and whoever is available and free, they'll come and help us. Just two of us won't be able to do the whole job, actually. So, and similarly, we have the database unit and seed storage unit. They help us with preparing the seeds and processing them. And when we need them, they package everything and send it to us. And so there's a lot of collaboration goes on in our unit between different groups, actually.
Sure. It's a well-oiled machine. And so, Melanie, just to make clear so people understand, you are USDA. You are federal.
Yes. And we have 22 employees that make up our unit, and our 15 of those employees are USDA federal employees. And the other seven full-time employees are University of Georgia employees.
Right.
So it's really a collaborative effort, not just that we're co-located on the University of Georgia campus, but also that we have a mixture of both state and federal employees in our unit. And they all work together really well. I think we're a great team. And not only do we have seed storage staff and technicians, we also have, we have maintenance mechanics, administrative staff.
Right.
Everybody works together for that common goal, and that's to preserve and distribute germplasm.
Sure.
So, I really feel fortunate to have such a great group of people.
And I think it's great you brought up too. It's a mixture of federal and state employees, which is great. I mean, there's part of the building you have a large presence on campus, and I love that structural presence. But some of that is USDA federally owned structure. I mean, it's when I first got here, that was the hardest part to learn. Was now what? Because it's a state facility, but there are federal facilities within the state facility, which is great. I mean, but it adds to and some of the people listening will probably have done this before. I brag on the seed bank constantly, and we try to do as many tours as we can. There's a misconception in Griffin and in the surrounding area that you being on campus is a security risk, and that's why the fences went up and all that. There's no truth to that. We give tours of the seed bank. You do an incredible job, and especially in the middle of summer, it's great to walk in the freezers and chill out for a little bit and then come back out. But it's just a wonderful public component of the University of Georgia Griffin campus that happens to be federal for the most part, and I love that. So that's great. Okay, let's talk peanuts, because peanut butter is my favorite thing in the world, but unfortunately I ate a lot of it. That's not good necessarily, but let's talk peanuts. One thing I want you to make, you're the peanut curator, which I love, so let's talk the huge number of varieties of peanuts there are and how they don't really all look like the peanut that's in a Snickers.
Well, we got in our collection close to about 10,000 different types of peanuts.
Wow.
From all around the world, actually. Anywhere peanuts are grown, we got a sample of it in our collection.
That's incredible.
And but part of that collection, what we call as the wild relatives of peanuts, actually. The ones you're talking about, what you saw in the greenhouses. Before I say anything, peanut is native to South America.
Okay, that was going to be what I asked.
It's originated in South America. Probably the cultivated types, what we eat, they originated in the northwestern Argentina and southern Bolivia.
Okay.
Most likely that's the area where the first cultivated peanuts were found, actually. And then, but they also have this wild species, the germplasm I'm talking about. They're scattered throughout South America, like in Brazil, Paraguay, Bolivia, Argentina, and Uruguay. So they are wild relatives, of course, of the peanut. And the plants, at least to some of them, look like peanut. And the flowers definitely look like peanut flowers. But the pods and seeds are very small. Compared to the normal peanuts.
And very noticeably smaller. Yeah, I mean, they don't even look like peanuts when you look at them.
Yeah, extremely small. But then they have very desirable traits that for a peanut breeder to use, actually. They have extreme levels of resistance to a lot of fungal diseases and virus disease. So that's the interest, actually. That's why we preserve them and then we maintain them. And lately, there's a lot of interest in the wild species because the peanut genome actually was already done. The peanut genome sequencing was done on the wild species first.
Okay.
And then we wanted to compare that with the cultivated types. And of course, the cultivated peanut types were also sequenced now. So we got the peanut genome sequenced. And in terms of talking in plant breeding, the peanut has two different wild species in it, actually, when it originally evolved in South America. So there are two different component wild species formed a native hybrid, a wild hybrid, and then which evolved into normal peanuts.
Wow.
So all those wild types, the two different wild types, and as well as the peanut was sequenced, all the genome was sequenced. So now we know a lot of sequences which are likely related to a different trait, for example, either for disease resistance or for nutritional traits. So there's going to be, from now on, in the next 5-10 years, that's going to be pretty exciting for peanut genome research and application of genomic technologies for peanut improvement, releasing new varieties with a lot of good traits and good features, actually, for the growers.
Well, so if you're as a peanut breeder, and this is something I think people don't understand either, you don't just overnight create a new peanut to I mean, it takes a little longer than that, doesn't it? I think people sometimes don't understand the scientific process it takes, and especially when the word breeding's after someone's name.
Yeah.
Kind of talk about that process.
Yeah, that's
and that involves Miley a lot, I know.
That's a wonderful question you brought up, Lou. In any crop, actually, not just in peanuts, by the time we release a variety, out of all this research takes anywhere between 10, 12 years.
Exactly.
So, say, for example, if Miley and I make a cross hybrid in 2019 in the greenhouses, and then by the time we see something productive or even useful, it would be 2029 or 2031.
And why does it take that long?
So what happens is when we create a hybrid, the first generation hybrid would have 50% of genes from each of those parents,
right.
Actually. So then as we advance those, particularly in a self-pollinated crop like peanut, when we advance them, they start segregating, actually, in the later generations.
Okay.
Either most of the plants would turn out to be like one type, or one of the parents,
okay,
or the other parent. But we want a combination of those two parents, actually.
Sure.
So if I'm looking for high yield from one parent and disease resistance from the other parent, and in the hybrid we look for types when they're segregating, for the which have the combination of high yield as well as resistance, actually. So you got to select them generation after generation, and each generation they'll be segregating until like six or seven generations later.
Okay.
They become more or less uniform, actually, what we call as homozygous. So once they become uniform, they don't segregate anymore. That's when you take that that seed and advance it into multi-location tests,
sure,
replicated tests, to make sure what we saw in the early generation is still stable and really good resistance is holding up in different environments and over a couple of years and replicated testing. And if it does, that's when we consider it for releasing, actually. So it takes anywhere between 10, 12 years before a variety is released or developed, actually.
Which means you have to be very patient to be a plant breeder of any type.
Yeah, in any other research too, probably.
Sure.
What we do is it's a cyclical process. So every year you make new hybrids,
right,
new crosses, because whatever is going to become useful would take so long. So,
sure.
And then by the time you try to release this, there may be a new disease or a new pest.
That was going to be my next question. The thing, you have to almost be a mind reader or tell the future as well, because you're looking 10 years out, or six or seven anyway, before you get something stabilized. Everything in the world could have changed by then. Yeah. So it's got to be a little nerve-wracking as you work through that. So we all appreciate what you do, because the peanuts y'all are making are pretty darn tasty.
I think that actually highlights the importance of the collection. What you're talking about now is because you don't know what to anticipate the new disease is going to be, or the new environmental condition that you're going to have to deal with. And so we maintain things in the collection, and we might not see their value now, but later on, future generations, you know, it might be a certain seed sample has a trait that's very important to the future generations, and that's why it's so important that we preserve this material.
Absolutely. And as we continue to see, whether it be in the human population or anywhere else, disease and things that we thought weren't around anymore start popping up again, it makes complete sense to have a background of seeds that were growing during that time that may actually hold the key to that. So I think it's incredible. It's amazing what y'all do. And, of course, I like everything y'all do, like grasses, but I really like peanuts. And the main reason I do is because when you showed me, it was really so neat to see from native to what I consider a peanut. Because, again, when we first walked up to the table, and this has been a couple of years ago, I didn't think what you had laid out were peanuts. And it was a great educational story to learn that how we got to what makes Georgia so proud, the peanuts that's in about every Snickers bar you ever ate that came from here. Okay, let's move back to Miley real quick. You've been there for over a year, which is great. Tell me something, and you weren't a peanut person we might have eaten them, but you weren't a peanut grower before you came here. What's something that you've learned, or what's something that's really been a great experience for you within that year?
Well, I don't want to admit this in front of Sean, but I honestly did not know that peanuts were underground.
Well, there you go. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't know that till now.
Well, during our interview, he said, you know how peanuts are grown, right? The pods are actually underground. And I just smiled and shook my head, yes. But, yeah, he's taught me a lot. I'm learning a lot about the cultivated peanuts in the field and a lot about the wild species that he was talking about. I'm kind of starting to learn how to identify the different types. But,
okay.
It's a learning experience. Every day is something new.
And that's awesome. I think that's a great attitude to have in that. And I think you're right. I mean, and again, shaking your head yes was the right thing to do. Got you the job, and now you know that they. But again, I'm telling you, it's like anything else. I think a lot of people would be shocked to hear that peanuts grew underground if they just haven't ever seen them grow. Most people have no idea how anything in agriculture works. So it's probably more common than you might think. Okay, so Melanie, I forgot to ask this when I went back, but if someone goes into the system as a researcher and says, I'd like peanuts, I'd like to get this, they can look at what you have, what the characteristics are, and then say, what's the process after that? I know you've got people, and you mentioned it briefly, but if I order seeds, what's going to happen? How do your people make that happen?
Well, your seed requests will come in through our database.
Okay.
And we have a seed storage manager who screens our request, and she'll basically send it out to the curator, the scientist responsible of that collection, and they will evaluate the request and make sure it's a legitimate request.
Okay.
Or we might have follow-up questions to the person who requests the material. And if we see it's a legitimate research or educational request, we'll approve the request. And then our seed storage personnel, we have technicians that will go in and to the freezers or cold rooms and pull the samples, and then they'll package them up and ship them out.
So. And what? How do they? Is there postage included with that?
No, we ship free of charge.
That's kind of what I wanted to get to. Not only is this an incredible public system that's federally managed and owned, but this is not common across the world. When you send them out, you pay the postage to send to these people. I think that's incredible. The first time I heard that, I'm like, how? No wonder the federal government's in trouble. <I'm> just kidding. I think it's a great component of what y'all do. And it helps distribute to a lot. How many distributions do you do a year?
On average, 40 to 50,000.
Good night.
So
that's incredible.
It's quite a lot of requests that come through our.
Wow.
And a lot of them go to the Southeast area to
okay.
university scientists or private seed companies. And we do ship globally, too. We have a lot
right.
of foreign requests we distribute to.
Any idea how many countries that historically have been sent to? I'm sure most. I don't know. I mean.
Oh, I don't, that's a good
okay.
question. I'm not sure the answer, but we do. I know we distribute to quite a variety of countries.
That's
I
awesome. That, so. And are there any, if other than maybe ones that are on watch list or something, are there any countries you can't ship
very
seed
few.
To? Okay.
So.
That's
and
cool.
that's, you know, that's very few we don't ship to. So, but most of them we freely distribute to. So.
Very cool. And Miley, for me and you, I think Sean needs to plan a, I used to call them environmental scans, but a trip to South America for the three of us. Or Melanie, you're welcome to go too.
Yeah,
Tony, you can go too. To search for new varieties of native peanuts. I think that would be awesome. And if there happened to be around some ancient ruins or something, that would make it even better for me personally. But so would you work on that?
Yeah. In fact, I had the privilege of going to Brazil and Argentina in
Ooh,
the
okay.
past few years, actually, to the native regions where the peanuts are. And then it's just, like you said, Lou, just fascinating to see them. What I tell everybody is, even today, to go into some of those jungles and mountains to look for peanuts is hard.
Sure.
And imagine, like, the collection was, like Melanie mentioned, our Griffin collection started in 1949.
Right.
So scientists, researchers went there at that time, actually, to collect these, or at least they collaborated with somebody from those countries to send it here. So it's when so much effort and vision and passion went into that, so we feel it's our real obligation to preserve them really well and then make sure they're available to all the researchers worldwide. Actually.
Absolutely. It's not easy work. I mean, and then the other thing to bring up is you didn't invite me on either of those trips. I'm just saying, just for the public record, I probably would have went, but that's all right. I'm not hurt at all. But I lost my train of thought when I said that. Sorry about that. But I've completely lost. Tony, why don't we? No, it's a little early. We'll do. Can we go to our break real quick?
Yes,
I've lost my train of thought, but it's hard for me to do. I was trying to be funny. I lost it. Let's go to that next break. We'll come back and catch up.
In the latest announcements from the University of the Georgia Griffin campus, the Kids Book Cooking Basic Camp with Trudy Gill will be offered again this year, this time from June 10th through the 13th. The four-day camp will offer both morning and afternoon sessions. For information and registration, you can visit the UGA website at griffin.uga.edu and simply click on the Continuing Education link. The Dundee Cafe, located in the historical UGA Mule Barn, will celebrate, well, it already did, that the official grand opening is going to be Thursday, June 13th at 11 a.m. Chef Marcy Bradbury from the Farm offers fresh culinary delights for breakfast and lunch Monday through Friday, along with, and get this is pretty cool, take-home pre-ordered casseroles. The scrumptious meals and specialty coffees are served both inside and on the veranda outside. The Dundee Cafe sits in the heart of the Griffin campus and is a welcoming place to meet and eat for the entire community. The renovation of the 100-year-old Mule Barn was made possible through a donation from the Dundee Community Association. Dundee Mills operated in Griffin for better than 100 years in the area across from the Experiment Station, which is now, of course, the University of Georgia Griffin campus. The campus store, which is located on the first floor of the Flint Building at 1109 Experiment Street, has new UGA and Georgia Bulldog items arriving weekly. The shelves are stocked with officially licensed apparel, souvenirs, and gifts. Campus store hours Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Information on current undergraduate and graduate degrees offered through the five university colleges on the UGA Griffin campus can be obtained by visiting griffin.uga.edu, or you can call 770-412-4400. Time now to dot the I's and cross the T's on this week's University of Georgia Griffin campus news. For that, here is your host, Dr. Lou Honeycutt.
Thank you, Tony. Welcome back, everybody. I don't know what happened right before the break.
Have the giggles?
I still do kind of have the church giggles. I don't know why. I was kidding Dr. Tallery about not inviting me on his trips, and for some reason it just tickled me. But the kind of week that's been going on, I needed that, so I actually appreciate that, Sean. That was great. But welcome back, everybody, to the show. We are talking with the USDA Plant Genetic Resource Conservation Center people or Conservation Unit team, or at least part of the team, Melanie Harrison, who leads the team, Dr. Sean Tallery, who's the peanut curator, and then Miley Mobley, who is a little over a year into it, biological science technician working with peanuts and other things on the with the unit. So, Melanie, let's talk, and all three of y'all, let's talk future. What's some of the, anything going on in the future, or what's the future plans for research or for the unit or things like that?
Oh, one of our main goals is to continue to preserve the material that we have in the collection and keep up with the distributions and distribute our material in a timely manner. We also do a lot of characterization and evaluations of our material, so we'll continue to do that. We're looking more and more at nutritional components of the different samples that are in our collection. We have a biochemistry molecular lab that's part of our program, and they look at different traits in the collection, and a lot of those are biochemistry chemical traits, such as oleic acid, protein, amino acid content, and things of that nature. So we'll continue to characterize the collection and then make sure it's available and it's in high quality, too, make sure the seeds are increased as they needed or needed to be, so that they maintain the viability of the collection.
And so, tell me, right around 100,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are there plans to grow that more? I think it's grown in the last few years. Wasn't it like 96,000 a couple years ago? Or I mean, has it grown?
Germination. Now we've done a lot of germinations.
Okay.
We try to do a lot of seed increases. I mean, that's one of our biggest challenges is doing the grow outs because they're complicated. A lot of our crops, if they're open pollinated, we have to control pollination so that there's not cross pollination between the different samples in the same species. So if we have insect pollinated crop, we have to cover them in cage covers, and then we rent beehives to put in there so that the pollinations will stay within that one sample. And that can be very laborious.
Sure.
And then also if we have one a crop that's cross pollinated and it's wind pollinated, we have to separate those by distance, which that makes field spacing and things like that a little more intricate.
Sure.
And so that's one of our biggest challenges as we go forward is making sure because the larger your collection gets, you know, the more seed increases you have to do through every year to make sure it's maintained properly. So.
Sure. And then the facilities, the cool and the freezing facilities, do you have enough room to grow if you had more things
yes,
come
Yes, we
in?
Do. We do have, we've not too, well, it's been probably 5 or 6 years ago. It seemed like the other day we added to some of our cold room facilities. So we do have the potential to have more in our collection. We have all of our samples split. I think 98% are split into actually two different samples. So if we have one sample that was collected in a unique place, we'll put half the sample at minus 18 degrees Celsius in the freezer that maintains it for long term, and then we put the other sample in cold storage. So when we distribute, we go into the cold storage, which is about the temperature of your refrigerator. So our seed storage personnel don't have to keep going to the freezer.
Cool.
You also don't have to keep pulling that bag of seed in and out of the
right.
freezer. So it may last a little longer. So that's something that we make sure all our seeds are in two different places, too. But we do have enough room for acquisition of new material. We do have collection trips that our scientists will go on routinely. And it doesn't have to be our scientists only. It can be people outside the USDA system,
okay.
the university personnel that will go on collection trips. And find unique populations, and they'll add it back to our collection. So I've had the privilege of doing switchgrass collections. I've been on.
That's a great segue. That's what I was going to ask you about your grass trips, because and we got to qualify grass trips as grasses trips.
Switchgrass
trip. Yeah,
so switchgrass is a native perennial grass to the United States. It was one of the tall grass prairie grasses, but it's
Absolutely.
Actually found, you know, through the southeast and up to the northeast. So I've been on collection trips from Texas all the way up to Maine looking for switchgrass populations.
And how did you do that? That's what I love about this.
So a lot of our time is spent riding on the road and looking for, we go in the areas where we think there might be switchgrass
mm-hmm.
based on the climate. And also the National Resource Conservation Service had identified some populations, you know, back in the 80s and 90s.
Sure.
So we kind of follow those routes. And so we'd drive along and somebody would shout out switchgrass and we'd see a population. We'd, you know, do a U-turn, go back and collect this material. A lot of it's, you know, material on the right of way.
Sure.
And unfortunately, several of the populations that the National Resource Conservation Service had identified in the 80s and 90s were no longer there.
Oh, okay.
Might have been, you know, a shopping center
sure.
here, or the highway expanded into the right of way. You know, so you know, widened the highway, and so then some of those populations weren't there that they had identified before. But we did find a lot of material, new populations, and we collected that and brought it back, and now it's available in Grin.
And that's a great. I mean, I think it's a great part of what y'all do. I mean, there has to be the collection phase for all things. I mean, it's not just you don't just store forever. I mean, it's a living system, and I love that. And there's even living parts of it in the garden as well.
Yes, we have some material over in the garden too. We have the eastern gamma grass collection, clonal collections in the garden, and we also have Napier grasses in the garden.
And as a grasses guy, that's one of my favorite parts to look at in the garden in the summertime, because they just get huge. Your
yes.
eastern gammas get huge. They're awesome. But so very cool. Okay, well, so that's kind of what's next for the unit. Chom and Miley too, what's next in peanuts, or what are you looking at towards the future in peanuts besides new cultivars or new yeah. ones that you're breeding?
Yeah, one of the things I'm excited about, Lou, I mentioned about the peanut genome sequence being done, and our state is so important for peanut production in the country, actually, as you have alluded to earlier. So the peanut industry is right now extremely interested to DNA fingerprint the entire collection, actually.
Okay.
At some point. I'm looking forward to that. What we call as genotyping. So, for example, I said like we got close to 10,000 different types of permits.
Right.
So, at some in the next 5 years or so, as a curator, I would like the whole 10,000 to be genotyped, actually. And then what it does is it cleans out or it shows all the, if there are any redundant samples or duplicate samples.
Sure.
And based on the DNA fingerprints. So we can narrow it down, and so we can identify the actual unique types that we have in the collection. And then we already have a lot of data on those, so we can see a unique type from, say, Australia in the collection may have a good profile with biochemistry or with other traits. So that's what I'm excited about in the next, as a five-year plan, actually.
And I think it's great. And what's really cool about everything you just said is it really is typifies why agriculture is so important, because you do everything from the creating, or you're a peanut breeder, but you're working everything, as is Miley, from the field all the way through the lab with Brandon and Tallis or whoever's doing it for y'all, but in the lab sequencing and doing, so it is big science. And a lot of people think of agriculture as not being real big science, but I'm telling you, come to the Griffin campus, it covers all areas, and that's a great example of how it does. And I've got to believe, or tell me if I'm wrong, once everything is sequenced, it's going to make it a little easier for you to compare and contrast and look at things, because you got the genetic sequence in front of you.
That's true. Once everything is sequenced, we can really, like I said, look at each one and then pick the ones that we want to use in the breeding program for desirable traits, actually.
That's awesome. Okay, so Miley, you're going to get the last word, because we got about a minute and a half left. But so tell me, as you've started this process, and now you're, and obviously you've been successful, because I've heard really good things about you, what are you looking at towards the future? And are you really maybe looking at graduate school later on? Or if so, will it be University of Georgia? You know, I have a vested interest in maybe of that. But what are some of the future plans that you have as a kind of a new employee or a new team member on the Griffin campus?
Yes, I am looking into getting a master's degree and hopefully a doctorate in the future.
Awesome.
Definitely with UGA. And hopefully one day I can take Chom's job.
Ooh, there you go. That's awesome.
He's prepping me for the future.
That's very cool. And what's cool is, you did you ever in your you know, mind at all think, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that you would be the peanut person or be a peanut person?
No, I could have never imagined it. I'm so glad that things have worked out the way they have, though.
And I think you've picked a great, I mean, the grass is everything are good, but I think for some reason the peanut collection just mesmerizes me. I don't really know why exactly, other than I love peanut butter so much.
Thank you.
But I think you've picked a great person to work for and under and with, and certainly under Melanie. But I think that the mentorship that you're going to get is going to just breed success in you. Breed success in you. So, again, I wish you the best of luck in everything that you do, and certainly all the rest of y'all, the best of luck. But any final comments y'all want to make? We're about out of time, but anything we forgot to add in that when I got the church giggles that we might have needed to add in?
No, thank you for having us on the show. We
Absolutely.
Appreciate sharing our story, and we enjoy doing tours and you know, sharing with the public what we do.
Awesome. Well, thank you all very much. We've had a great show today. Tony, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week.
We thank you for joining us this morning on the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. We wish for all of you a very safe and happy Memorial Day weekend. Be careful if you're going to be out on the roadways. And be sure to join us next Thursday morning at 9 a.m. for the next installment of the UGA Griffin Campus News.
Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realty, proud supporters of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus, and proud to bring you this week's edition of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. As the UGA Griffin Campus grows with the great educational opportunities for our children, Round Oak Resources Tree Farm is growing our future with trees to support and assist our environment. Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors are proud supporters of the UGA Griffin Campus and area youth activities in Griffin and Spalding County. You've been listening to the University of Georgia Griffin News, a program to keep our listeners updated on the exciting and varied activities at the UGA Griffin campus with Dr. Lou Honeycutt and his guests. The program is heard each Thursday morning at 9 a.m. on WKEU AM 1450, 102.3 FM, and also The Rock 88.9 FM, and streamed live on our website, WKEUradio.com. Today's program has been made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farms and Murray & Company Realtors. Join us next Thursday at 9 o'clock a.m. for the University of Georgia Griffin News.